Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And we are giving you, I think, the gold, or I should say the nation's treasure, when we go through the ratification debates, because as these men are defining it, as they're laying it out, they are literally articulating and stating that there is no wiggle room for politics on things that are not delegated. They kept on pointing out they can't do that. They can't do this. They have no power delegated in that instrument being the Constitution. So with that, let me just quickly remind you that there is a constitutional compliance campaign in the auditor's race in Missouri. Jerry Wistrand is out there running a very lone race. He's running as a Republican. Now, he's doing that, just so everybody understands, I told him that he needed to really differentiate himself as the true Republican. I think that we need to start helping everybody understand what a true Republican is, because the Republican Party was created by Jefferson and Madison. A true Republican is a person that is seeking office that is going to constrain themselves with those powers delegated only. They're not going in there to assume powers. They actually created that party to go after the Federalist Party that was assuming powers. So, with that, welcome back, Sean. And
good to be here, sir. Thank you.
And I'm glad. So we covered something that we ended the show up with, or ended the show off with, I should say, whichever, however you want to look at it, with this comment that it was apparent that Congress had no right to alter the internal relations of a state. Now, I want everybody to understand that, and actually, do you remember going through the ratification debates?
Yes, sir.
No, I'm sorry. I said ratification
debates.
The notes on the Constitutional Convention.
Yes, sir.
And I really painstakingly brought up every time they talked about new states in the Union. Right? Remember that?
Yes, sir.
And so, in so doing, I highlighted the language that they wanted to inject into the Constitution, which was that that Congress would have the power to regulate the apportionment for new states coming in, that they would be able to regulate their sovereignty. They would have the ability to control, you know, the fact that they weren't coming in with this concept of equal footing. They were going to give themselves power to make laws necessary in not just in the territory, but the states as well, in meddling in their government affairs. And so when you read the language in the Constitution, you go, well, yeah, Article 4, Section 3 states that Congress has the power to make the needful rules and regulations respecting the territory and property belonging to the United States. Now, there's plenty of lawyers out there that believe that every state is property that belongs to the United States, and it's not. It is not. As a matter of fact, Madison and the framers, they clarify all of this. How did we get here? Well, because people get away with saying and generalizing, well, all states are a part of the territory of the United States. Well, no, technically the territory of the United States is a set of land that is not a state yet. Territory of the United States is land that the federal government has the onus. They have the responsibility, because that's what Article 4, Section 3 of the Constitution is, responsibility for Congress, not a power. When they acquire territory, it is their job to prepare that land to basically admit that land into the Union as an independent and sovereign state. not to just hold on to land so that they can be rich in resources. If that was the case, then they wouldn't have actually created a plan for every state, or I should say for the entire territory of the United States, in, you know, dividing it up and adjoining to the Union. When you look at the Louisiana Territory, Thomas Jefferson did not want all of that territory to be a part of the United States. It was his plan to give most of it to the Indians, well, share it with the Indians as well as the U.S. government so that the U.S. government could, you know, use the land for mineral purposes, for resources, so that the government would then be able to have its own industry. Now, what do you think about that, that Thomas Jefferson wanted to do that, just that one thing alone?
What do I think about it?
Yeah.
I think it's against the Constitution.
Yeah, but so he wanted an amendment to grant that, though. That's the, that was the whole point of that amendment, was giving them the power over, you know, the control of the minerals, the rights of minerals, the right of owning that land to be able to harvest the timber, the minerals, those types of things. And so, in other words, he was opening the door for federal industry. You see my point?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so that would have been very bad. And fortunately, that Congress didn't, you know, even entertain that amendment. When we really look at Thomas Jefferson, had he had his way with that one amendment, it would have been almost a kiss of death to the Union in a, such an earlier way, in an earlier fashion, giving the federal government this power over industry. And so, in a way, we really dodged a huge bullet with that. And I think, if I remember correctly, I remember hearing a story that happened after the Louisiana Purchase, and I think it was because of this amendment that Madison had to school him and say, are you kidding me? Do you realize what you're doing? What door you're opening up? It's almost like this idea of creating a balanced budget amendment to say, well, it doesn't matter what you spend as long as you cannot spend anything greater than 3% of the GDP or whatever, something like that. And it's, in other words, giving the federal government no more boundaries of you can only spend money on the powers of these objects delegated. You can spend on whatever you want as long as you don't exceed this. Now, even though they may have the ability to spend it on whatever they want, they don't have the ability to regulate all those things. One would think, oh, well, with that would come that. But, you know, it's the way the Constitution was written, it made it very hard for duplicit people and I'll just say pernicious people to be able to derail it with just a simple amendment to do, you know, spending, just on spending. Because let's say they had the ability, they went out and spent money on buying land, and they started controlling and regulating the land. Well, the Constitution is very clear because it enumerates the type of land that it can possess and operate. Forts, magazines, shipyards, arsenals, and needful buildings, dockyards and needful buildings. So if it's not land for that purpose, and they went out and bought it, then they couldn't really possess it or exercise it for any purpose at all. It would just be land that they would hold as an asset. And when we get into the Virginia debates, I hope we find, I hope we cover it. I may want to make sure I scrub it to look, because they do talk about the danger of allowing the federal government to become rich with resources that are theirs and not the state's. Because when they actually have the ability to start bribing and using that type of affluence, it's bad enough that they can print and mint the coins and they possess the money. But when they have the resources and assets on top of that, because technically when you look at the money is the state's. They're only tending to it. But they're controlling where it goes and so forth. So, in a way, there's this door that they've gone through that they started doing bad things, and Hamilton was the guy that swung that thing open, and he danced in and out of that door. He took it off the hinges and said, look, we don't have a door anymore. We've got a portal. Anyway, all right, so we were covering the jurisdiction, or I should say delegation of powers, and Colonel Varnum was basically, you know, started this off. Now, Mr. Choate, I believe is how you pronounce that, was the next person that kind of spoke up about this. So we now have somebody speaking of delegated powers, and there's going to be a follow-on comment and a follow-on comment and so forth. So let's go ahead and keep this going. So let's pick up what Mr. Choate says.
Mr. Choate said that this clause gives power to Congress to levy duties, excises, imposts, etc., considering the trust delegated to Congress that they are to, quote, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, end quote, and etc. If this is to be the object of their delegation, the next question is whether they shall not be vested with powers to prosecute it. This can be no other than an unlimited power of taxation, if that defense requires it. Mr. Choate contended that it was the power of the people consented to appoint, that as all power is lodged in them, this power ought to be supreme. He showed the necessity of its being so, not only for our common defense, but for our advantage in settling commercial treaties. Do we wish to make a treaty with any nation of Europe? We are told we have no stability as a nation. As Congress must provide for the common defense, shall they, asked Mr. Choate, be confined for the imposts and excise? They are alone the judges whether 5 or 1% is necessary or convenient. It has been the practice of all nations to anticipate their resources by loans. This will be the case of the United States in war. And he asked, if our resources are competent and well established, and that no doubt remained of them, whether in that case the individuals who have property will not cheerfully offer it for the general defense. After adverting to the idea of some of its being a consolidation of the Union, Mr. Choate concluded by a brief display of the several checks contained and securities for the people to be found in his system.
So interestingly enough, and I got to point out, because I say this, when I mentioned that debt is fraud, they have the authority in the Constitution to take on debt for these objects that are delegated to them for the national defense. If we are underrun and we are, you know, being invaded, we can take on debt to do that. We can take on debt to, help me out here. We can take on debt to prepare for, you know, a national, or I should say a world war calamity, and making sure that the states are ready to be able to defend the United States, that the Navy is capable of prosecuting a war abroad, or at least defending our interest, those types of things. They have the authority to do those things and take money, or I should say, create debt to do that. They do not have the authority to take money or create debt so that they can print books and teach your children to consider being more diverse, or to teach your children, you know, things that, or teach your children anything other than things pertaining to the militia. Now, they have the authority to do that. They have the authority and the requirement to pay for the preparation and training for people to serve in the militia, not to become socially engineered, you know, transgenders or what have you. I hope you're understanding this point. It's the same thing with growing of food. They have no authority whatsoever to take money, to take on debt, to pay for farmers not to grow any food, and to actually pay for farmers to biologically engineer food sources to become fuel, and then mandate that food source, that fuel-grown food, to be integrated into a national energy supply, or to even regulate the energy supply, or to even have a national repository of energy. What that means...
What about for defense of the Union?
So
you need fuel for that.
It's so... I would say that when it comes down to fuel going into the system, because so what they do is they have this, it's called, if you look it up, I think it's the CCC, the Corporate Commodities something corporation. It's the CCC where they have a national food stores of grain, you know, sugars, butter, those types of things. And that's supposedly for defense purposes. Do they have that responsibility or do the states have that responsibility? And should the federal government assist the states in that responsibility?
I think all of the above.
So I would think that it would be far better that the federal government not be the repository of a national, I would say a national fuel reserve, that the states would basically do that. It's one thing for a naval fuel reserve, because that means that they would have reserves around the world, not just here, because, you know, it doesn't help your ships running out of gas or running out of diesel or whatever the fuel is that you're using just in the United States. Yeah, shoot, we got to get towed back to the United States to fill up. So it's one thing to have something for the Navy, because that's a unique thing. But the paradigm had been, and it had really grown into the nation would do these things. And I believe that, that what that did was it, what's the best word for it? It alleviated or it relieved the states of the burdens that they should have actually been bearing in trying to make sure that there was the ability to support their citizens in time, in hard times, with whether that be storms or what have you. Oh, no, the national government is going to take care of all those things. Well, if that's the case, then it should be in the Constitution that they do that. But that's not. What is in the Constitution is that they have this ability for the national defense and welfare to basically, when that's when you look at this responsibility, is really the states. They're supposed to be funding it, but the states are supposed to be doing the executing the training. They to have arsenals and all these other things, but it doesn't mean that they have to be federal arsenals. And as a matter of fact, if the states were really smart, they would have made sure that each state had what it truly needed. Now, let's just look at it. Maybe when we started off, they probably would have had equal repositories of, you know, defenses and arsenals and forts along the northern border of Canada and America and Mexico and America. But I think probably over the course of the last 150 years, logic, common sense, logic, and reason would have prevailed and said, I don't think we need to be amassing, you know, all of this money and resources nationally in those states, because we don't see, there's no threat there. Not that we're going to abandon the fact that that's a border and, you know, it's going to throw caution to the wind of not having any type of defenses, but we don't need to have the amassing that we do because we're afraid they're going to invade us. Because if we look on our southern border, they are invading us and they're not even doing that job. As I look at this, where would we be if the states were managing this the way they should have been? And telling the federal government, because the federal government only needs to call forth the militia for three purposes, for executing the laws, for suppressing insurrections, and repelling invasions. And they haven't really done that in a long, long time. What they've done is they've said, well, we have friends and we got resources, we have these advantages, these things we want to do, with, you know, calming the world tensions of this war in Europe, this war in Asia, what have you. And they become this policeman of the world involved in world wars. Now, it's one thing to use the Navy to do that and the Navy resources to do that. But it's another thing, because we've already read a little bit, and we're going to go through more of the debates here. where they really talk a huge concern about taking the militia out of the state, because I think we've probably covered it a little bit already, where when you look at the states, they didn't want to see their citizens being deployed by the federal government for long periods of time away from the state. Right, wrong, or indifferent, what they should have been doing was the states really should have been actually preparing to take care of their own citizens. And because even though there may be states that were ill-prepared, then those states would either be shamed or they would, you know, finally go, okay, we got to fix this. And it doesn't mean that the other states can't help. But everybody, and because this goes back to when we look at the federal government in doing this, they've only proven that they've weaponized this. I'm not sure. There's a site I used to love when I was going through business school. I used to love reading their articles. It's Seeking Alpha. And they pointed out in 2006 how George W. Bush was opening up the commodities of the grain and the food supplies, the federal food supplies, and moving those into the market space. In other words, they were taking grain and putting it out for sale in the market space. And in so doing this, and this, they started this in about 2006, 2007, and it went into the Obama kept it going. What ended up happening is in 2011, when we ran out of rice, when we ran out of wheat, when we ran out of food going into the food supply, guess what happened to the cost of food? Because there seemed to be this unlimited abundance of food keeping the prices down. Price of food shot up. And the price of food shot up. And I remember in this article, Seeking Alpha, that this sharp rise in food throughout the world literally created the Arab Spring. That all of a sudden, parents or, you know, family, you know, leaders of the family were having to decide who got to eat and who didn't get to eat because they couldn't afford the food for the family anymore. And this really created what we would call this Arab Spring, where they started revolting because in many of these societies of the Arab world, you know, these people didn't have jobs. They don't have jobs. I mean, people that are out there trying to be, let's just say, entrepreneurial and, you know, making things better for themselves. But most people were just happy with whatever the government was giving them and just making a little spending money on the side. So all things being equal, we could see how each of these states, all of a sudden, it just happened all at once. From Egypt, Somalia, all of these different places just literally started falling to the Muslim Brotherhood. So they weaponized our food supply to literally create a problem. When had the prices gone up naturally, instead of a real sharp jump, then the world probably would have been able to take that on a little bit better. But the point is they do things like that where they are coming, they have an outcome that they're seeking. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
And so do we really want the government that is spraying us with chemicals? Do we really want the government that has taken our food supply? And by the way, they've not replaced that. They have not restocked the food supply to any similitude to what it had under the Reagan, you know, Bush, Clinton, because for the most part, they haven't just sat there. I think they were waiting for the food crisis, the droughts or what have you to, you know, to really make a big impact. And they did. So the point is that, you know, do we want, is it best that the federal government be able to do that? They've only proven that, you know, given the power, they're going to do things that, that's not so good, if that makes sense. So I still contend that we need to actually be pushing and getting the states to step up. This should be their responsibility. I mean, Wyoming has, you know, 500,000 people. California, they got a lot of savings to do. If they're going to save up for a rainy day, we'll be right back after this promo, folks. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so bringing it back around, as a matter of fact, in looking at the amendment that Jefferson offered in 1803 that would have literally set the stage for a federal industries ran and to feed and for the purpose of the federal government, I think the same thing for the stores and the supplies and those types of things. Is just as equally bad, but I can understand how we've grown up with this idea that free cheese. You have to be of the generation that remembers eating USDA free cheese when they had the surplus. They just gave it out at the schools or what have you. Families went and got their 5 pounds of cheese every week. So.
I absolutely remember that cheese.
Yes,
yeah. You can get.
It was good.
Yeah, it was.
and it was free. So, anyway, I think the point is that we have to, we really have to look at everything and say, why would the guys, I try to get people focused on what does our government do the best? They kill people. They are the best war fighters in the world.
But that's not even the government.
But it's what they
it's
do
the
best.
The spirit of liberty in the people government has to fight their wars for them.
And so, but that's one thing that they do. They do really, really well. The federal government has created a war machine that is unsurpassed. But I don't think we want them to do those same things, because with the cruel and I'll just say swift actions of government, it can be very, very oppressive. It can be very bad when government uses the types of force that they use, because they do that well. I'm okay with, these training programs. I'm okay with, I'd rather see the training programs move back to the states. Now, when we look at what the Army had become under the Dick Act and everything else, as they were growing and growing and maintaining the standing army of the cavalry and so forth and growing the West. It just seemed like they wanted to do more and they were getting away with it. So let's do more. And they did. I was going to actually say this and I didn't. I forgot to say this. So when we look at the contiguous United States, the 48 states from Atlantic to the Pacific, for the most part, those states were formed in the early 40s. It was, I think, by 1848 when all of the what we call the 48 contiguous states, almost all the land was now in federal government possession. It was little patches of territories that were purchased, like the Pacific Northwest purchase. That was the Oregon, Montana, I think going over to maybe even the Dakotas. No, actually, I think the Dakotas might have been included in the Louisiana. But nevertheless, if you look at what land was acquired in different treaties and what have you, then you can see that by 1848, all the land was already earmarked, and at that point in time, they had basically broken down the territories, and they started establishing, you know, maturing certain areas. Like Oregon became the first state on the West Coast to actually, I think it was the first state in the Union, wasn't it? It was before California, right?
You got me, Bert.
So I thought that most all kids had, you know, were taught in school, you know, what the states joining the Union and so forth. And so let me pull it up, because to me it's kind of important, because when you look at Oregon, Oregon's right there in the middle. But I think, was California in the Union by that point in time? That's the question of the day, I think. And, you know, I guess the real question is my system even up and available?
California.
California came in when?
September 9th, 1850.
1850, and Oregon joined 52, 51?
I'm not sure.
Because Washington was created a territory in 1853 out of the Oregon territory. So I'm going to guess it was 1853 when
Oregon was 1859.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, I know that they set aside the Washington territory in 1853. And in so doing, they started creating these counties. As a matter of fact, I found a pretty interesting website that you can go to and you can
1889.
Look. 18 what?
89, Washington.
Joined the Union, yeah. Yeah, but I think their first convention was in 1860-something to create a state. They tried to create a state in the 1860s. And for the most part, it was the Democrats didn't want to see that many Republicans come into the Union. So they kept them from coming into the Union as a state, because they had already met all the thresholds. They were just playing with the thresholds. It was about politics, but there's a pretty interesting website that you can go to that will, you could take a state and or an area, and you could get the map of the counties, a snapshot of the counties at the time. 1850, it gives you all of the county boundaries and the county names in that state or in the area, the territory at that point in time. Pretty cool. So you kind of see how, you know, the states were progressing, and where, you know, because when you look at a county means that there is a court, and a county means that there is a sheriff. It is a actual physical government on the ground. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
And so that's how the federal government, in admitting states in the Union, that's exactly how they did it. They started organizing it and getting the state ready. Then they were admitted, and for a few states, they were admitted with, you know, equal footing. But it didn't take long. Well, actually, it was about 30 years later when they were admitting states in the Union. They started playing shenanigans with the Northwest Ordinance and so forth. So anyway, as we look at these states and how they kind of joined the Union, the 48 states, the point is by the 1840s, they had already had a map out of developing the 48 states with district courts and counties, setting up counties into these territories. And slowly, when the population got to a point where they said, okay, we got enough people in that area, we can now create a state. Look at the Dakotas, and if you look at Wyoming, you look at these types of states and go, are those states even, are they even capable of functioning as a state, right? In other words, do they have the revenue to maintain their government? Do they have the ability to pay their own way? Can they sustain themselves? I guess that becomes the real question always, is can government get, can it be supported by the organic resources within its boundaries, like a county? And most people think today that North Dakota, South Dakota, Wyoming, they're so dependent on the federal dollars that they don't see how Wyoming and these heartland states can even survive without the federal government. You know why that is? It's because the federal government has created rules and regulations keeping these states from being able to harvest their own resources and assets. When you look at the property that the federal government's taken, whether that be for forests, for whatever purpose, all unconstitutional. Now you can't even have your own, you know, I'll say wood mills. You can't have your own lumber. You can't mine. You can't harvest the coal under the ground when they start regulating you. And so that in itself, those types of economic regulations that are not within the Constitution are in another way a form of warfare, where the federal government is going after a state without authority to say, you can't be productive in that market space anymore. We won't allow it. All of this out of the Massachusetts debates. Isn't this amazing? Okay, so Mr. Choate made his comment. Now we have General Thompson, who kind of, he's an anti-federalist, so that's why the AF is there. So he makes his points and kind of, you know, comes up with his rebuttal over these delegated powers. Go ahead.
Sir, the question is whether Congress shall have power. Some say that if this section was left out, the whole would fall to the ground. I think so too, as it is all of a piece. We are now fixing a national consolidation. This section, I look upon it, is big with mischiefs. Congress will have power to keep standing armies. The great Mr. Pitt says standing armies are dangerous. Keep your militia in order. We don't want standing armies. A gentleman said, we are a rich state. I say so too. Then why shall we not wait 5 or 6 months and see what our sister states do? We are able to stand our ground against a foreign power. They cannot starve us out. They cannot bring their ships on the land. We are a nation of healthy and strong men. Our land is fertile, and we are increasing in numbers. It is said we owe money, no matter if we do. Our safety lies in not paying it. Pay only the interest. Don't let us go too fast. Shall not Massachusetts be a mediator? It is my wish she may be one of the four dissenting states. Then we shall be on our old ground and shall not act unconstitutionally. Some people cry, it will be a great charge, but it will be a greater charge and be more dangerous to make a new one. Let us amend the old confederation. Why not give Congress power only to regulate trade? Some say that those we owe will fall upon us, but it is no such thing. The balance of power in the old countries will not permit it. The other nations will protect us. Besides, we are a brave and happy people. Let us be cautious how we divide the states. By uniting we stand, by dividing we fall. We are in our childhood yet. Don't let us grow too fast, lest we grow out of shape. I approve that we are a respectable people, in possession of liberty, property, and virtue, and none in a better situation to defend themselves. Why all this racket? Gentlemen say we are undone if we cannot stop up the Thames. But, Mr. President, nations will mind their own interests and not ours. Great Britain has found out the secret to pick the subject pockets without their knowing of it. That is the very thing Congress is after. Gentlemen say this section is as clear as the sun, and that all power is retained, which is not given. But where is the Bill of Rights, which shall check the power of this Congress, which shall say, thus far shall you come and no farther? The safety of the people depends on a Bill of Rights. If we build on a sandy foundation, Is it likely we shall stand? I apply to the feelings of the convention. There are some parts of this Constitution which I cannot digest. And, sir, shall we swallow a large bone for the sake of a little meat? Some say, swallow the whole now and pick out the bone afterwards. But I say, let us pick off the meat and throw the bone away. This section, sir, takes the purse strings from the people. England has been quoted for their fidelity, but did their constitution ever give such a power as is contained in this constitution? Did they ever allow Parliament to vote an army but for 1 year? But here we are giving Congress power to vote an army for 2 years, to tax us without limitation. No one to gain, say them, and no inquiry yearly as in Britain. Therefore, if this constitution is got down, we shall alter this system entirely and have no checks upon Congress.
So it seems like he repeated a few different arguments, right?
Yes, sir.
And so one of them was, well, let us amend the old Confederation. Where was he? Where was General Thompson with the last 8 amendments that failed? Was he not there? I mean, does he really think under the Articles of Confederation that they were actually going to be able to get any amendments?
I think it's kind of funny how he says, we're a rich state. Let's just go back to the Articles of Confederation. We're good.
Yes. Under the Articles of Confederation, they were able to undermine it and not really be bothered by what the needy states were doing. There was no fear of an amendment because they knew that they would never get 100%. Rhode Island promised that. At least that's exactly what they were delivering for the first, 5 years or 4 or 5 years. They refused to give any amendment consideration. So he then talks about the need of a Bill of Rights. It just seems like this is the smorgasbord of the anti-federalist complaint. So we're kind of going on and on and on. And let me see here. How much further do we have? Let me see here. There's Mr. Niles. So we got taxation in Congress, delegated oaths, delegated. I'm looking for there it is. So when we get down a few more days, this is when we actually find Mr. Hancock and Samuel Adams speaking. And so let's go ahead and dive into this next one, which is the taxation under the Honorable Mr. Bowdoin. However you pronounce that. Bowdoin. Okay. There
sounds
we go.
Sounds good to me.
All right.
Boudin. So, taxation and the failing of the Confederation. In considering it, every gentleman will reflect how inadequate to the purposes of the Union the Confederation has been. When the plan of the Confederation was formed, the enemy were invading us, and this inspired the several states with such a spirit of union and mutual defense that a mere requisition or recommendation of Congress was sufficient to procure the needful aids without any power of coercion. And for that reason, among others, no such power was given by the Confederation. But since that reason bad ceased and the idea of danger being removed by the peace, the requisitions of Congress have, in most states, been little regarded, notwithstanding they solemnly pledged their faith to comply with them. This non-compliance has compelled Congress to increase the foreign debt of the Union by procuring further loans to pay the interest and installments due on former loans, and in that way to preserve the public faith which had been pledged to foreign powers. It has compelled them, in order to prevent the consequences of a breach of faith as relative to those powers, to enter repeatedly into those ruinous negotiations by which, quote, the United States jointly and each of them in particular, together with all their lands, chattels, revenues, and products, and also the imposts and taxes already laid and raised in the same, or in time to come to be laid and raised, are for the whole. Mortgage for the repayment of those loans by installments and for the payment of the interest on them annually. These debts must be paid, bona fide, according to contract, or be further increased by procuring. If procurable, further loans, which, ruinous as the measure is, must be continued unless the states empower Congress to raise money for the discharging those debts. It will not be in the power of the United States, and I'm sure it will not be in their inclination, to rid themselves of those debts in the same base and ignominious manner in which a faction in one of them are endeavoring to get rid of theirs. To the same cause, a noncompliance with congressional requisitions are owing the repeated but necessary breaches of public faith in regard to the payment of the federal domestic debt. And hence, as relative to the joint consolidated debt, the inefficiency of the public finances and the bankrupt state of the federal treasury, which can never be remedied without empowering Congress to levy adequate duties and taxes. Without such a power, the accumulating debt will never be paid, but by a forcible collection, which our foreign creditors know how and are able to apply if, unhappily, it should be necessary. The several loans, which by contract are to be paid by installments, will, in case of the failure of any of the stipulated payments, become the whole of them immediately payable, and any of the property of any of the states, whether public or private, that can be most easily come at, will, in that case, be seized and applied for that purpose. This mode of reimbursement or reprisal will be upon the trade and navigation of the United States, and in proportion as ours of this state may be larger and more extensive than the trade and navigation of other states, we shall be the greatest sufferers. This ruin of our trade will involve in it not only the ruin of the mercantile part of the state and of the numerous body of mechanics dependent upon it, but will most essentially affect every other class of citizens and operate most extensively to the injury of the Commonwealth. These are some of the consequences, certain and infallible, that will flow from the denial of that power to Congress. Shall we then, we of this state, who are so much interested in this matter, deny them that power, a power so essential to our political happiness? But if we attend to our trade, as it is at present, we shall find that the miserable state of it is owing to a like want of power in Congress. Other nations prohibit our vessels from entering their ports or lay heavy duties on our exports carried thither, and we have no retaliating or regulating power over their vessels and exports to prevent it. Hence, a decrease of our commerce and navigation and the duties and revenues arising from them. Hence, an insufficient demand for the produce of our lands, and the consequent discouragement of agriculture. Hence the inability to pay debts, and particularly taxes, which by that decrease are enhanced. And hence, as the necessary result of all these things, the immigration of our inhabitants. If it be asked, how are these evils and others that might be mentioned to be remedied? The answer is short: by giving Congress adequate and proper power. Whether such power be given by the proposed Constitution, it is left with the conventions from the several states and with us, who compose one of them, to determine.
So he kind of sets the stage in basically talking about how they're procuring loans to pay the interest on other debts. It's in the tune or in the similitude of somebody getting a new credit card to pay the interest off of another credit card. That's a good way to go.
Yeah, okay.
Okay. I mean, that's exactly what he's saying. So when we look at this grant of powers, whether they have the power to regulate religion, whether they have the power to come in and do these things, because again, they've already kind of talked about the Bill of Rights. I don't think that they've really hit it. I think we had one comment already talking about, you know, we don't need a Bill of Rights, because if it's not granted, they can't do it. So we see the fact that they have this power to take on debt, but we also see that it's being heavily, you know, amplified and reiterated and elucidated that they have very limited powers, very limited jurisdiction. And so in looking at all of these things connected, when the United States, this goes back to that debt being fraud. The United States, if it's spending money and it's taking on debt, to take debted money to spend on something that has no authority to do, then they have defrauded the American people, and they have gotten another nation to collude with them to do that. Because it is incumbent upon any loan entity, anybody that says, I'm going to give you money, to make sure that the money that they're getting, they have the authority to spend on the things that they're spending. So when China says, tell us how much more you want to spend on this bad crap, we'll be happy to give you more. In other words, the world has opened up its floodgates for America to continually spend on things that you and I should not be receiving, that our government should not be buying, spending money on, and being involved in. This is what I would say is the big scam of the world. This is what forces this next world economic shift to force everybody together. Because, oh, well, you know, we can't live within the means, so we'll have to make a shift so that we can all live together within these means. You're going to have to give up everything. Well, no. That's not our case. It may be the case because they have general powers. Britain has general powers. China has general powers. I mean, their government isn't tied to spending money on only these objects enumerated in their constitution. Our constitution is the only one that has that. That right there is the divine hand of providence segregating us from the rest of the world. And I know that word segregate is a bad word in most cases, but in this case, it's a divine or very good thing.
Set apart.
There you go, that too. So anyway, when we come back, we're going to dive into the one of my favorite parts where Congress is not immune. Where this is the one state, I think I mentioned this before, this is the one state that highlights this, that if Congress creates a law, that they cannot be immune from the misery of that law being inflicted upon the people. They have to equally suffer under the same laws they pass for us. So anyway, folks, I enjoy this. I hope you are as well as Sean and I. So we will be back with more. There's plenty to go through. It looks like we're about halfway through. And so a little over halfway in Massachusetts. I'm J.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic. We need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.